The inherent philosophy.
Interesting hypothesis.
Infer and describe the hypothetical relationship.
It's All Academic, and today we're going to talk about negotiating peace in a country that's in the midst of or still recovering from civil war. Well, it's not easy, but it's also not impossible, as history has shown in places like Ireland, for example. So when it does work, why does it work? And how can we solve the crisis in Syria, for instance, or get a realistic, at least, long-term solution for peace in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? Our next guest has spent some time pondering these very big questions. Dr. Jasmine Westendorf is a lecturer in international relations at La Trobe University. She's written a book called Why Peace Processes Fail, and she joins me now. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
What got you interested in this area of international relations?
I was lucky enough that when I was a teenager, my parents moved us all to Pakistan. And so we grew up living in the Afghan refugee communities in the Northwest Frontier Province at the time. So from a very young age, I was thinking about why certain people and certain young children my own age had been displaced and were living in fairly horrific conditions. So when I got to university, my studies really focused on issues of security. And when I got to my PhD, I thought, what better topic than looking at why it is that so many peace processes failed, despite all of the efforts that go into building peace after wars.
So let's get to your research about peace processes. What can you tell us about it? I mean, why do they fail? I would imagine part of the reason is that there's not genuine goodwill from both sides.
That's certainly an enormous part of it. And I should say, when I talk about failure, I'm not just talking about a return to civil war, because actually in most places, once there's a peace agreement, the peace agreement lasts, but what doesn't happen is that a stable, secure peace is established. So if you look at what people's lives are like in post-conflict societies, generally they keep being characterised by insecurity, poverty, inequality, and the same sense of distrust that might have sparked the war. So why does that happen? The international community has tended to focus on institution building rather than looking at the social dynamics that might actually motivate violence. So when you're building institutions, you're building electoral systems and new armies and new police forces, you're setting up truth and reconciliation commissions, but they may not always get to the heart of why it is the political, the economic, the social reasons that people choose to use violence.
You say it has a lot to do with external presences trying to solve the conflict in a place or country they don't understand. So, you know, looking at the Israeli-Palestinian crisis, you know, we've got the US intervening. Obviously, they don't have a stake in the game other than, you know, a broader foreign reason for needing stability in that region. What's the alternative, though, than that kind of approach?
The alternative is to work more closely with groups at the local level in these societies that deeply understand the dynamics of the conflict and the reasons why the conflict has occurred or is perpetuated. And there are certainly examples. For instance, in our region, in Bougainville, there was a very nasty civil war for a long time. But when Australia and New Zealand got involved in trying to help the Bougainvillians find peace, they really left the stage to the civil society organisations, the church groups, the women's groups, who knew the causes at the local level and could say, well, this is actually what we need and this is what we should be discussing and this is how we should be doing it. That certainly hasn't happened in a lot of places. I don't think that that's
the key. That was a good example.
That's a great example.
So what other success stories can you point to?
It's actually,
are there many success stories?
There's not a
huge number of
success stories.
Or are we going to run out of conversation now?
We can talk a lot more about the failures. The thing is that in a lot of places, there have been elements of success and elements of failure. And that's what my research tries to pick up on, what has gone well in certain places. And that tends to be like in Bougainville or like in Liberia, where the women's movement was again very involved in pushing the militia leaders towards a peace deal. That tends to make for a better peace than the externally driven processes of peace negotiation and then peace building.
So ultimately, the evidence is that if it needs to be locally led and then international partners have to follow that lead and bolster it. What is the role of women in all of this? Because you mentioned women quite a few times. Are you saying that where women are leaders, that the outcomes are better?
Look, the jury's still out on that one. I don't think that there is any evidence that women are innately more peaceful than men. But women represent half of the population, and they experience conflict in a very different way. And because of their specific social roles, they tend to bring some different issues to the table when they are involved in negotiations. It doesn't mean that they always have to be at the negotiation table. Obviously, that's an important part of peace negotiations, but there's an enormous amount that goes on beyond that in terms of getting groups talking to their communities about what their community is willing to accept. And I think that gets to the heart of why peace processes fail. There's often a very idealized view of what a peace should look like and what a post-conflict state should look like. And it's very idealistic. And if you think about countries where there's been violence between former neighbours or within families and across religious lines, I think we have to be a little bit more realistic and a little bit less aspirational about what we can expect. Maybe 5 years after a peace agreement, what we can expect is that they're not killing each other in the streets and that they're allowing their children to sit next to each other in a classroom, and that 10 years after, we expect that something a little bit deeper, and 20, 25 years after, there might be some form of reconciliation. We tend to expect all of that to happen within a neat 10-year funding period, which is a problem.
You've been looking at Syria, and we've talked about Syria, which is, you know, one of the biggest international issues of our times. And I understand you've just returned from a trip in the Middle East. Tell me what you found there.
I have been following the conflict in Syria because it's the biggest humanitarian catastrophe that we've seen in our lifetimes. The number of displaced people and the extent of that violence is just astounding. One of the things, I wasn't actually in Syria. It's very difficult to research in Syria, but looking at what's going on in the region, and particularly in Israel-Palestine. And my take on Syria at the moment is that we're focusing on this idealised peace. And the way the international community is looking at it is in terms of absolutes. Will Assad stay or will he go? Will ISIS be defeated or will they, survive? And I think looking a little bit more at the compromises that might be made, I suspect that in Syria's case, from the interviews that I have done, there are a lot of people who just want the war to end. And within communities, there's a lot of goodwill that still exists across the lines of the conflict divide, because up until recently, those people were living in communities next to each other and working together, and there are some great peace initiatives where they're still doing that. So I think looking at what those people are willing to accept is key to then saying what needs to happen at the national level to get a peace agreement in Syria.
So does that mean that you think that what sort of compromises do you think might be necessary? The transition away from Assad means that he still has to be involved, or his regime is still involved?
Absolutely,
what role for ISIS then?
Yeah. I think with Assad, the tricky thing is that he has an enormous amount of power, and in any conflict there's power imbalances and you can't get around them. There's no way he's going to agree to leaving just like that. He's got too much at stake, especially after 5 years now of conflict. So he has to be, whether we like it or not, a part of a transitional government. But hopefully what that would mean is he might be there for a year, and then the transition would happen to someone who's actually got more credibility and integrity as a leader, and that during that period, other groups also have representation. ISIS is a completely different question. You can't negotiate with ISIS. I think it's a problem when we conflate those two issues, though. The war with ISIS is something that stemmed out of another set of conflicts in the Middle East, and out of international involvement and out of a particular form of religious extremism and desire for dominance and political dominance. That's quite separate to the Assad regime's desire to continue their regime in the Syrian state, where they've traditionally not really been connected to those external battles.
I want to thank you for coming in. You've really articulated your research beautifully. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And that's Dr. Jasmine Westendorf. She's a lecturer in international relations at La Trobe University. Her book is called Why Peace Processes Fail, Negotiating Insecurity After Civil War. You're listening to RN Drive. I'm Patricia Carvelis. It's news time now.